LGBTQ+ community and beyond, including, but not limited to, mature subject matter such as sex and sexuality, personal experiences, and more. We aim to create a respectful and inclusive space for all. Listener discretion is advised. The views and opinions expressed are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of the producers and this outlet. Stay tuned for thought-provoking conversations and so much more.
Hi, everybody. This is Gino Vannelli. You're listening to Rainbow Country with Mark Tara.
Today on Rainbow Country, a flashback to my interview with Kids in the Hall, featuring Scott Thompson and Paul Bellini. That and more in episode 449, so stay tuned. For Gay Talk Radio, right here on Rainbow Country.
Hello, my name is Conchita.
And I'm Barbecue.
And my name is Hardcora. And we are the B-Girls.
You're listening to
Rainbow Country with Mark Tara.
Well, hello and welcome to a brand new journey on Rainbow Country. As I like to call it, a little gay radio show working to give voice to the LGBT community and beyond. And as always, I am your tour guide through Rainbow Country. I'm producer and host, Mark Tara. By the way, Rainbow Country originates from CIUT-FM in Toronto, and now proudly in syndication across Canada from coast to coast to coast. The Yukon, British Columbia, Saskatchewan, Manitoba, the east coast of Canada in Newfoundland, Ontario, even down to Buffalo, New York, and online. Well, thanks to you tuning in, streaming, downloading, but ultimately listening. Together we continue to build Rainbow Country into a nationally syndicated gay radio show, as well as being recognized as a number one Canadian LGBT podcast. So today, a flashback to my interview with Kids in the Hall, featuring Scott Thompson and Paul Bellini. On IMDb, he has 5 wins and 10 nominations, including 3 Primetime Emmy nominations. He is Scott Thompson. On IMDb, he has 3 wins and 7 nominations, including 3 Primetime Emmy nominations, and he is Paul Bellini. And those two multi-award-winning artists are from the Canadian legendary comedy troupe Kids in the Hall. And they join me in conversation on this episode to talk about their gay punk band, Mouth Congress, their new album, Valley of Song. We'll also find out how they joined Kids in the Hall, and so much more. Plus, in Hour 2, music from LGBT artists, independent artists, voices that we've come to know and love in classic disco, classic 80s, classic house. And on this episode, I'm featuring some classic 80s, some queer jazz, and more. All that lies ahead as we start Journey 449 through Rainbow Country, and our first stop, the Rainbow Country Bookstore. Today, Deep Sniff, A History of Poppers and Queer Futures, from British author Adam Smith, who reads from his gay history book that reveals the long history of poppers. And by the way, the reading is accompanied by the parody song, Just a Quick Sniff of Poppers, from drag duo Cookie and Kishida.
I was just a lad, I learned that anal sex was bad. The church said it was a dirty, rotten sin. But then I learned from other guys that no matter what the size, there's a simple trick to help you take that tick. Just
snip, the papa's house, the penis slide right in. The penis slides right in, you can take it with a grin. Just a quick snip of papa's helps the penis slide right in the most delightful way.
In the winter of 1866, actually, while a medical student in Edinburgh Royal Infirmary, Brunton met a patient called William H. This young man was only 26, but already had trained as a blacksmith and then switched to toll keeper. His first job may have required too much exertion for him to continue because Brunton's notes reveal that William suffered from heart trouble. When Brunton met him, William had recently been hit by a dull, heavy pain about the left nipple every 3 days or so, lasting for at least half an hour. The pain had come on after years of infrequent attacks ever since he'd suffered from rheumatism as a child. After a 3-week hospital stay earlier in the spring, William was back just before Christmas. Doctors gave him aconite, which slows the heart rate, and digitalis. When neither worked, Brunton gave him brandy. The strong stuff didn't help either, so there was only one thing for it. The experiment was not a stab in the dark. Brunton acted in a way that was consistent with his wishes to take basic research from the lab to the bedside, and only with a decent understanding of the actual effect in the body. He had read the work of another scientist, Richardson, that amyl nitrite dilated blood vessels, and had even discussed the effect with his colleague in Edinburgh, Arthur Gamgee, who had made some unpublished measurements of this effect. Brunton obtained some amyl nitrite from Gamgee, who made it for him, and consent for an experiment from his supervising physician. And this is how Brunton came to give his patient William amyl nitrite. On March the 12th, 1867, Brunton observed, "The pain came on as usual at 3 a.m. A few drops of nitrite of amyl were put on a towel and inhaled by the patient. The primary effect noticed was a suffusion of the face, and the patient felt a glow over his face and chest. The pain disappeared almost simultaneously with the occurrence of these phenomena, but returned in 3 minutes. He then inhaled 5 drops more. The pain again disappeared and did not return."
"I met this guy once in a bar who took me outside to his car. He spread my cheeks and tried to ram it in. I screamed, 'No, it's too big!' He said, 'Take it all, you pig!' Then he shoved this small brown bottle up my nose. And girl, I gotta tell you something, that quick snip of puppers let the penis slide right in. The penis slide right in.
Now I can take it with a grin.
Just a quick snip of puppers let the penis slide right in the most delightful way."
Good queer performers push their audiences forward into the future they desire. A good performance is utopia for a moment. In the Royal Vauxhall Tavern, all of these potential utopias were willed away when the police stormed in. Performances interrupted, orgasms foregone, connections broken. The police brought their alternative performance. The police did not just want to stop what was happening, they wanted to make their own utopia for a moment. They pulled on their costumes and they put themselves to work on embodying authority, power, intimidation. As individual officers, people with homes and hobbies, they had been moved by some newspaper stories about a deadly sex craze and by others that spoke of a horrible illness killing men who had sex with each other. They heard the words of politicians who spoke about preserving families and protecting children. As individuals, they may even have wanted no more gay or queer people. As an organized group of individuals, each wanting to belong to something bigger than they were, police officers were grabbed by the idea of cutting the number of queer venues. All we have is the records of their group performance, the way they stopped gay and queer people. They arrested our futures, at least for a night or two. The story of these raids is a story from the past, but it is about how we live in the present, creating a future. In every moment we are performing, making choices about the future we want to build for ourselves and others. We can be inspired by other people who are better than us at articulating a future, but it is not some distant, formless thing. How we are living now is always creating a future, whether we like it or not. Whether or not we are trying, we are performing a future. As a genderqueer dancer stretches the limbs they have, they bring us into their utopia for a moment.
Wow, this stuff is amazing!
Yeah, let me try them. I've never done it before.
Wow, this is hot.
Oh, shit.
Hey, Cookie, let's put something in my ass and see if it works.
I just dropped the whole thing on the carpet. Here, bend over. Let me try this chair.
Oh, my God, I can't even feel anything.
Shit, the whole thing fits.
Wow, the room is spinning right now. These are great, but you know what? You can't use them if you're taking Viagra.
Why?
Well, because you'll die.
Oh, that's a problem.
Yeah.
Wow, this stuff is amazing.
So this goes out to all the guys who are too concerned with size. It really doesn't matter anymore. As you watch his manhood grow, shove that bottle up your nose. Relax,
relax
your hole,
your hole,
and slide down on that pole. Just a quick sniff of the top, the penis slide right in, the penis slide right in. You can take it with a grin. Just a quick sniff of the top, the penis slide right in the most delightful,
making it not frightful.
In the 60s, before the internet, to find each other, queer people needed to actually get together in real space and real time. Since most places didn't tolerate our kind, depending on where you were, your options could be limited. Large cities might have a few specialized commercial spaces, but in the absence of those, it was basically public washrooms, parks, or house parties. They all had their downsides. Commercial spaces required you to spend money, and that's one of the reasons why they were mostly for men. Even in places as big as Toronto, there was seldom more than one lesbian bar at a time. Lesbians earned about 60% of the male wage and probably had more dependents. The economy just wasn't there. The old adage was, gay men go to restaurants, lesbians hold potlucks. Washrooms and parks were also pretty much boys only and could be dangerous. Plus, parks in the Canadian winter, not so good. You could freeze your willy off. House parties, you needed to know somebody, or know somebody who knew somebody, and so on, and be invited. In terms of commercial life, Montreal had led the pack, developing a Sin City reputation during Prohibition in the U.S. in the 1930s. And where there's sin, there's always a place for us. Toronto the Good and Vancouver took a bit longer, but in 1974, Toronto had enough anonymity and a critical mass to produce a small commercial scene. At first, it was mostly straight bars where we were tolerated in a corner as long as we behaved. Next came a few straight-owned venues that served gay clientele. By the mid-70s, a new class of gay entrepreneurs emerged and started to open up on Church Street where rents were cheaper. But not everybody lived in Toronto or Montreal. In smaller centers, where businesses couldn't meet community needs, the lesbian and gay liberation movement of the 70s came up with a new model. Defy economics and do it for ourselves. We might not have a lot of capital, but we did have free labor. For example, the Lesbian Organization of Toronto established a non-profit community center in a ramshackle old Victorian house in 1977. It held dances and brunches and drop-ins and provided meeting spaces and a coffee house and hosted a phone line for a whole generation of women. Loot, as it was known, was following a strategy already developed elsewhere. In Saskatoon, the Zodiac Friendship Society opened its community center in 1973. Edmonton and Calgary soon followed suit. HALO, the Homophile Association of London, Ontario, started in 1974. And the Halifax Gay Alliance for Equality first began running dances in the Turret in 76 and later turned that into a community center. By the end of the decade, there was a network of lesbian and gay groups providing community spaces in dozens of medium-sized centers across Canada, volunteer-run and community-controlled. This is Tim McCaskill, a gay liberation dinosaur from another planet and author of Queer Progress. Up next, Kids in the Hall. Scott Thompson and Paul Bellini.
Hi, I'm Syeda Garrett, co-writer of Michael Jackson's Man in the Mirror, and you're listening to Rainbow Country with Mr. Mark Tara.
And hear our tale of the girl on the mountain and the boy from the vale. She milks her goats, which he churns into cheese. Every opportunity she's down on. She can't even think. She takes in a deep breath and then she starts to sing. At first very softly, quiet as a mouse, then turns up the volume.
Bellini. Hi, how are you?
I'm fine, Mark. How are you?
I'm well. I am well. Scott Thompson. Bonjour, comment ça va?
Oui, ça va bien.
Ah, bon, bon. Ouais. I have to say, thank you both for being here to have your voices, your stories be heard by the LGBT community and beyond. So thank you for this. The two of you came to prominence through Kids in the Hall. But what I think most people don't know about you, about the two of you, is your love of music, in particular punk music. You guys have a gay punk band called Mouth Congress, and you just released a new album called Valley of Song. Valley of Song. Paul Bellini, let's be serious for a moment and let's talk about the sonic landscape of this album, this music album, this comedy album. How would you describe this record, Valley of Song?
Well, it was very ambitious in that there are 16 songs. It took us a year to write, a year to record, and a year to mix. It was a very long project. But we tried in those 16 songs to try different genres and different crazy ideas. I think we treated every song very specifically, like wanted to give each one its own character. Mostly I would consider a rock album. But there are ballads. There's other kinds of things in there. There's two country songs.
Yeah, there's a song that's kind of like spoken word poetry. Yeah, it's all kinds of things. We weren't really attempting to have a kind of an overall narrative to the album or any kind of sound. It was just each song was a separate individual that we treated, you know, as a person that we would bring into the album. So the album's there's all kinds of people, all kinds of songs, all kinds of points of view, all kinds of sounds.
Well, our background is sketch comedy.
Yeah.
And that's how we approach the whole record. The songs are usually from the point of view of a character, and they're all really different characters. We always try to do something different, tell a different story with every song.
Scott Thompson.
Yes.
Going back to the 80s, maybe, the origins of Mouth Congress. How did the two of you create Mouth Congress?
Well, Paul and I met at university. We went to York University. Paul was in film and I was in theater. But I mostly hung around with film people. Basically, Mouth Congress, it started in a weird way. We didn't actually begin it till we'd graduated, but we would just jam. A lot of our friends were musicians. Neither Paul or I have really any musical background, but we like music. And I like to perform, and I didn't know what I could do at the time. We were so young and unformed. I was like, oh, whatever. If most of our friends had been dancers, we probably would have ended up choreographing dance. But it's just happenstance. We met, we wanted to be creative. And then once we graduated, and I think we both found that it was difficult. Like, I wanted to be an actor and Paul wanted to be a filmmaker. And we also were young gay men who came out into a war. So I think we used Mouth Congress as a way to channel our sexual ambition into art so that we didn't die.
Yeah, it was an outlet, of course.
It was an outlet. It saved our lives. I mean, it saved my life, that's for sure.
So, Paul, Mouth Congress, you guys have released a number of recordings. There's Waiting for Henry, that was your first album. The Pollution, you've got Dollies, you've got Live at the Rivoli, and Valley of Song, most recently. In 2019, you guys released a documentary on Mouth Congress. So, Paul, what inspired you guys to want to release a documentary in 2019?
Well, you know, Mark, when we were starting to do live shows, we tried to be very creative and make them presentations, build in lots of costumes, character bits, really make them variety shows. And we would videotape them because one of our musicians had a video camera. And looking back on all that footage, I thought, this would be really interesting for some of our Kids in the Hall fans to see. They would be very intrigued by this footage. And so we started to talk about how to build it into a documentary. And it took a long time. We started in 2011. And it really took until 2019 to finally finish it. So that was a long process. And I think we had to find a form for it because it's not really just a documentary. It also tells a story off the top, and there's a whole live show at the end. So we tried to make it all seamless, and it was very tricky.
Yeah, and when we started, I mean, obviously there were times it took long periods. We didn't, you know, I lived in L.A. most of that time, and so we wouldn't do anything for ages. But also, the thing about that makes it different than a documentary, it's not a mockumentary, but it's full of lies. As long as our goal was, we say, as long as it's funny and entertaining, it doesn't matter. So what we did was, we had no success. So we thought, nobody wants a documentary on Mouth Congress except us. So basically, we crafted a narrative that isn't really true, and we treated it like that was our story. And so that's what we did. Like, we make it sound like we were so wild that we were just about to be stars, but the society couldn't handle us, which really couldn't be further from the truth. But this is much more entertaining.
Yeah, so, it's true. Yeah.
So, Scott, in, I believe it was 2016, Math Congress did a live performance at the Rivoli Club in Toronto.
Mm-hmm.
And was that performance sort of like the backbone, the spine for the documentary?
Yes.
Yeah. Yes.
Like, was it featured, like, was that performance featured in the documentary?
Yes.
As well as the rehearsal process and the writing process.
Yeah.
So the documentary does show us at work and usually arguing with each other. Mm-hmm. And then finally, the show is the result of all our hard work and arguments, which was a very funny show. I thought it worked quite well.
Yeah. That's it. We just put the show together because we needed an ending for the documentary. And so it would be, we thought it was interesting to put us all together again. And it was so much fun. And it, people loved it. And like really young people that had no idea who we were, didn't even know really who the kids in the hall were. They loved it. So that kind of gave it, that's what rebooted us. Cause I just, we just thought this is so much fun because it's just art. Like there's no one telling you no. And in my career, I've just basically heard a lot of no's. In the last 5 years, it seems like I've heard no more than anything. And so this album was a chance to make art where no one could say no unless it was us.
So Scott, why do you think you've been hearing no so much, like you just said, lately over the last few years?
Well, the world went insane. And I think it went actually, I think the genuinely insane during the pandemic. And I think that the noose of political, I think that what we used to call political correctness, I think the last 5 years went into a death grip. And I think what we saw was we watched the freedom of speech, the war on freedom of speech move from the right to the left. And that was a very profoundly difficult thing to accept and handle. So I think people got very frightened of free speech. And after the experience with Amazon and the kids in the hall, I came out of that deeply bruised. And I went, I want to do something that is just for us and the fans. And with no one saying no, people just, the people that have the money that produce things, legacy media, whatever you want to call them, the last 5 years, they've just become increasingly afraid of, I guess, cancel culture. I guess that's part of what it was. It just kind of reached a kind of a fever during the pandemic. Now I think we're on the other side. But that's what I think happened. And I think it's interesting. I think it's like the West particularly kind of turned on itself. And, you know, and people became afraid of free speech. So that's my thinking.
So, Scott, if you don't mind me asking, you just said, you just said you felt rather bruised coming out of that 2022 Amazon Prime Video season of Kids in the Hall.
Mm-hmm.
What? Why? Was
the censorship?
Was that not a good thing?
No, it was a terrible experience for me.
Mm. Because they were...
They were awful.
Hmm.
They wouldn't allow anybody called monologues, so that's, you have to deal, think of that. They wouldn't allow us to do, they didn't want us to do any of our drag. They let us, they sort of let us. They didn't want us to comment and all. They wouldn't really let us weigh in comically on any of the major fault lines of society, which is what the kids in the hall do. And that was a very terrible experience. And also, you know, I mean personally, I felt personally attacked.
Amazon Prime Video, who knew? Who knew?
I think most people know, but I couldn't even hire Paul because he was white.
Yeah, and like I said, it didn't help that it was shot in the summer of 2021, which was still lockdown. And it was very hard to do a comedy show, which requires conviviality and a certain freedom and relaxation of process. And it was very rigid. The constant testing, the sequestering, the masking. It really, I thought for me, changed the dynamic of the creative process. It wasn't fun to shoot, basically, you know?
Mm. Well, On a positive note, I will say that on that 2016 live recording, I have to say a couple of my favorite tracks are Be My Whole.
Be my whole tonight. Be my whole. Be my lover. I'll be your cover. Be my whole.
And She-Male.
She-Male, master of the universe. She-Male, mistress of the universe. She's wise in all the things about the sky. She rolls with that. And about her cat.
Oh, yeah, neither of those would ever have been allowed on the Amazon show, trust me. Yeah, She-Male would have. No, oh God, are you kidding me? They would have literally put us up against the wall and shot us.
Paul Bellini, the name Mouth Congress, how did this name come about? Is there a story behind it?
Well, we had a copy of the Kama Sutra. It was the Sir Richard Burton translation. And we used to flip through it because it described all kinds of sexual...
And all we'd ever read before was the Elizabeth Taylor translation. So this was very different. Richard Burton was an explorer. Anyways, I'm sorry. Go on.
But that's what their term for oral sex was.
Yeah.
Mouth Congress. And we thought, oh, that's cool. That sounds great. Let's use that.
So oral sex?
Yeah.
Mouth Congress and the Kama Sutra?
Yeah, that's all it is. Yeah. It's oral sex. And that means cunnilingus and fellatio.
Yes.
So it's very inclusive.
After this Rainbow Country update.
Hi, I'm writer Adam Smith, author of Deep Sniff, A History of Poppers and Queer Futures. You're listening to Rainbow Country with Mark Tara.
Hi, I'm Jamie B of TGCD Style Toronto, and I'm a professional feminization makeup artist and stylist providing male-to-female transformations and mentoring to those who identify as a cross-dresser or a trans woman. I first heard of Rainbow Country and Mark Tara in trying to find a radio station that specifically caters to the LGBT community, and I'm so grateful I found this station. It's crucial having a platform like Rainbow Country that welcomes all aspects of the queer community, including allies like myself and what I do. It casts a spotlight on specific needs and interests of human beings, ensuring that people from all walks of life are being validated. It's a real privilege to be able to work with cross-dressers and trans women by helping them align themselves with their feminine energy through the glorious feminization process. So, I want to thank Rainbow Country and Mark Tara for providing this platform for all of us.
Starting on Sunday, April 13th, Rainbow Country will be heard in Liverpool, Nova Scotia on QCCR-FM. Queens County. Appropriate, don't you think? That brings us up to 13 outlets carrying Rainbow Country from coast to coast to coast. If you, or maybe someone you know, would like to be a guest on Rainbow Country to get the word out about an upcoming project, maybe you have an interesting story or journey to share, well, simply head over to marktara.ca, where everything is connected, and send me an email. It's just that simple. And you too can have your voice and your story be heard coast to coast to coast.
Hi, my name is Joanne Vanicola, and I'm an actor and a writer, and I was first on Rainbow Country with Mark Tara on discussing the massacre at Pulse Club in Orlando. I realized how important it was for our community to have a radio station, specifically for our issues, to talk about people in the LGBTQ community and to provide an outlet for our stories, to discuss our politics, culture, and give voice to the issues that matter to us. And of course our artists and the things that we do globally and right here in Toronto, and talk about culture. And without people like Mark Tara providing a space for this with a radio show like this, then we wouldn't have that voice. So support, tune in. Thank you.
I'm Brian Bradley, author of Outrageous Misfits, female impersonator Craig Russell and his wife, Lori Russellidi. You are listening to Rainbow Country with Mark Tara.
So Scott Thompson, you are a multi-award winning artist.
I am? Wait a second, let's hold on here. Mm-hmm. No, I'm not. Not really. I haven't won much. What have I ever won? I don't think that's true. Sorry, but...
Bingo.
Like, I haven't won anything. What have I won? I got a couple Geminis, I guess, which don't exist anymore. Why don't you say multi-nominated?
Okay, you're multi-nominated.
Here we go. That's better.
You have a successful career in acting, including being on HBO's The Larry Sanders Show, NBC's Hannibal, Netflix's FUBAR. Growing up, you mentioned earlier, did you always want to be an actor, want to be a filmmaker?
I wanted to be famous. I really didn't know what. I wanted to be an actor, but I didn't really know what an actor was. I mean, I didn't grow up in an artistic family. My creative loves weren't really encouraged. I grew up in a very masculine family. I have four brothers. It was all men. So it was a very rough growing up, so I had to hide all of those tendencies. And I want to be a movie star. I just wanted to go on talk shows and be funny and then make movies. But I didn't really act in school very much. Like, I did one play at the very end of the high school because people kind of forced me into it. Because the truth was, I didn't want to do it because I thought that if I started doing acting, everybody would know that I was gay. So everything for me when I was young was everything to hide that I was gay until I got out. So I would never have told anyone what I really wanted to do because I thought that would out me.
And how have you found fame treating you?
Well, it's back and forth. Sometimes it's good, sometimes it's bad.
Because I guess in your mind, you said you grew up, you wanted to be famous.
Yes.
So now that you are famous, now that you are known, how does it live up to that fantasy that you had?
Well, it's not at all what you think it is. I think fame is just another way of, it's basically, I think, people that feel unloved, a lot of it, and it'll make you feel like you're loved. And there is love when you're on stage and people are clapping for you. You've done a good job. That is a form of love. But I think people, it's difficult when you first get thrown into it. I think it's hard when you're young. I think almost everybody has a period where they kind of lose themselves for a bit. And I think I did that. But I've been very lucky that my fame is not that big. It's cult fame. So I think that's allowed me to actually maintain my realism, whatever that means, my authenticity. Because I think in a way I dodged a bullet by not becoming too big. Because I think when you're too famous and too rich and too successful, that's an incredibly good excuse for people to hate you and turn on you.
Well said.
Yeah.
So Paul Bellini, you've been on Canadian television, Kids in the Hall. This hour has 22 minutes. She's the Mayor. You're also a teacher. You teach sketch comedy at Humber College in Toronto. For yourself, you wear many hats: a writer, a performer, a teacher. For yourself, Paul Bellini, you feel most comfortable doing what? Wearing which hat?
Well, I only think of myself as a writer, to be perfectly honest. And even teaching is an extension of my writing behavior, my writer behavior. And performing I was never good at. It's something I do, but it's not a natural thing. The only natural thing to me is writing.
The only natural thing for you is writing.
Yeah.
And did you grow up wanting to be a writer then?
I actually did. From when I was very young, I thought it was a really cushy job. Like, my dad had to get up at 5:30 in the morning to go work at a mine. And sometimes, you know, in the middle of winter, it just was, I thought, what a brutal experience for a human being. And then I thought, writing, that sounds like the kind of job you don't have to get up at 5:30 to do. So I'm going to do that. And, you know, from when I was a kid, I kind of had an aptitude for it. So it was, for me, honestly, I never really did anything else.
And writing for television, writing for TV, how do you find that? Because I'm sure it's a very specific type of writing.
Well, it's the most lucrative form of writing, and I always recommend it to my students. You want to make money as a writer, get a job on a TV show, because you're paid all the time. Movies pay out once. Theater, you get some royalties. But TV shows, if it runs for years, it's great. So just in a practical sense, it has a nice feel to it. Television writing is also, you're always working with other people. You're in production. You're not just surrounded by other creative people, but tech people as well. And the fans reach out. You have the broadcasters to deal with. It's really quite a fascinating industry. And I liked it a lot, I have to admit. I kind of miss being in production.
And
it's been a while.
And in regards to writing, have you writing a novel, writing a memoir, writing those type of outlets? Have you thought about doing those? Or
sure, it's fun, but I'm a little lazy when it comes time to actually sit down and write something. I'm getting lazier. I'd rather just watch movies. I know that sounds terrible. I'm very lazy these days.
Have you ever thought of writing a movie?
Well, to write a movie, you mean?
Yeah.
We made two movies. We made a movie back in 1995 called Hayseed, which was kind of an adaptation of Candide. And it was shot and played at the Toronto Film Festival. Mm-hmm. A couple years later, me and the same director worked on, Josh Levy, we worked on a project about a house full of webcams. And this was back in 2003 when the idea was very much in its infancy. Mm. I think there was like Jenny Cam and, you know, because she'd walk around in her bra and had tons of subscribers. And, you know, it's pre-streaming. That's kind of like high-speed internet.
Very Big Brother.
Very Big Brother. So we wrote a movie about it, which is also a psycho slasher film. And that one, that was also filmed and finished, and I think we sold it to like the Canadian Movie Channel, First Choice or whatever it's called. I can't
first
remember.
First Choice, yeah.
Yeah, one of those.
President's Choice, I think it was called.
So I had those experiences. And then, you know, I was involved a bit in Brain Candy and stuff. So movies are fun, you know. Mm.
Scott Thompson, how did you get involved in Kids in the Hall originally? How did this come to you?
Oh, well, I was an actor. I was trying to be a regular actor, like, you know, auditioning for Stratford and Shaw and all commercials and all that sort of thing. But I started doing improvisation a little bit at theater, something called Theater Sports, which played at Harborfront. And anyways, one night, my friend Darlene Harrison, now known as Darlene Treen, she asked me to go to a show, a midnight show of a group called the Kids in the Hall, who were actually at the time, there were seven or eight of them. And they were composed of the four guys from the West Coast and three guys from here, the original Kids in the Hall and Mark McKinney and Bruce McCullough's group called The Audience. And they did a midnight show at the Poor Alex, which was a club on Brunswick. Was it Brunswick? And Bloor. And I remember when they came out, it was like love at first sight. I knew instantly that what they were doing was what I wanted to do. And I instantly decided, like right there, that that was my future. And I needed to be in that group. And so without really thinking, I noticed that there were donuts under the chairs. And the theater was almost empty. And I thought, why do they have donuts? And I guess I thought, I didn't really think it through, but I thought, oh, donuts, they probably need this for a bit. So I just started taking all the donuts. And while they were performing, I started throwing it at them. I just wanted them to notice me. I could have gone really badly, but I think they were so blown away by this guy in the audience that threw things at them and thought it was a good thing. I remember afterwards, Bruce came up to me and said, are you the asshole that threw donuts at us? And I went, yes. And I was proud of it. And I think that stuck with them. And then Mark McKinney, he saw me perform at Theater Sports maybe a week or two later. And I did this insane sketch. I don't know what I was thinking, where I mind pulling a turd out of a toilet. And then I held it aloft like Yorick's skull in Hamlet. And I did a monologue to it. And I think that combined with the donuts made them realize we need this guy. So they asked me to do a show with them. And I arrived with a bag of wigs and dresses. And I never went anywhere. After that, it was like I was in, and I wouldn't. I just went. You have no choice. Mm-hmm. I just knew. You know, sometimes you just know in your life what you have to do.
Mm-hmm. And you made it happen.
I did. Yeah.
Paul Bellini, for yourself, how did you get involved with Kids in the Hall?
Well, I hung out with Scott at school, and likewise, when I saw the first show he did with the kids in January 85, I too felt like I was looking into my future. And I thought, these are the kind of creative people I really want to be involved with for the rest of my life. It's amazing what a strong magnetic pull it is. And still.
We just did a show. We did shows this week.
Shows this week. And what could keep me away? So it was very similar, and I just tried to make myself useful.
That's it.
Not a performer, because I knew there's no way I could compete with these guys. I mean, no way. So I just made myself useful as a friend and as an assistant and as a buddy and a hanger-on and whatever you want to call it. I was there all the time.
Yeah.
Until, again, they couldn't get rid of me either. So
yeah, and we started writing together. Before you knew it, we were a team, and that was it. But it's true. What Paul said really sticks with me, because I've heard this over the years from people, and it sticks with me. Number one, make yourself useful.
Oh, Arnold said that.
It was Arnold Schwarzenegger said it to me.
Arnold Schwarzenegger. Yeah.
Make yourself useful, whatever it is. And if you do that, you will have a good life. And it's really like, find a purpose, find a group, find something that you can, even if you don't do it well, but you will. If you apply yourself to something, regardless, you will become good at it. And people want people around them that are useful, right? Even if it's you don't have to make yourself useful at the beginning with what you want them to think you are for, therefore, right? So what Paul said, you just, I'll be a dishwasher. I'll be the secretary. I'll build the set, whatever. Whatever that is, you can keep it in the future, what you really want to do, but you shouldn't let your ego get in the way of just doing a lot of shit at the beginning, because that's life. And also when you're older, you won't resent it. You'll never look back and go, God, I worked too hard. Right. God, I didn't have to do that. No one ever looks back on their life like that.
Scott, for yourself, looking back over, you know, your time with Kids in the Hall, are there, especially the shows that you, the TV shows that you've done with them, are there moments, characters that stand out to you more so than others?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I mean, I have a lot of characters, but there are probably six characters that are truly fascinating. They're almost like alter egos more than characters, like Danny Husk, Buddy Cole, Francesca Fiore, Fran Wilson, Manny Coon, even though I hardly did him very much. But I guess the top four would be Francesca, Fran, both called Fran, Buddy, and Danny.
Weston.
Oh, Weston, Esther Hazy, yes, who never really took off, but was a very big character for me before television.
Well, they're all different sides of you, right?
Yeah, basically, yeah. They really are. And so they're characters that just are very, very close to me.
And Paul, for yourself, what stands out to you most when it comes to your time with Kids in the Hall?
Well, they turned me into a character. I mean, I was just a guy on the show that one day they needed a contest prize, and Mark suggested me in a towel as the gift that would go to a winner. And it was just such a weird idea. Everybody loved it. And, you know, in a way, Mark gave me my entire career at that moment. And pretty much every job I've ever had since then is because of the towel guy. So, I don't know, pure luck.
So here's my last question, and it's for the two of you. And Paul, I'll start with yourself. What do you hope audiences come away with after they've experienced, whether it's the, you know, your Mouth Congress music, if it's Kids in the Hall comedy or anything that you do? What is it that you hope your audiences come away with after they've experienced Paul Bellini?
I want them to experience the feeling that anything is possible, that you can try different things, that you are not limited by some sort of identity that other people foist upon you, that you are a free thinker and kind of inside you can be a monster or a lion and really approach things with energy. And don't be afraid to fail. Of course, it's the great lesson in comedy is, you know, failure is what makes you great. Mm-hmm. But I think just all that, like daring, you know, liberate your ideas. Mm-hmm.
Well said, well said. And Scott, for yourself?
Well, I like people to hopefully amused, hopefully they laughed, provoked, maybe even turned on, just entertained. I like to entertain, but I like to make people think. But it's like also what Paul said, there's no such thing as failure, really. I mean, all failure really is a chance to get better at something. So you can't really fail and you can't really bomb. Because most of us remember those things almost better than the triumphs. Mm. Like I know I've told my bombing stories more than I've ever told. No one wants to hear a story of triumph.
Yeah, right? But also bombing gives you more.
Yes, it does. Well, it's more, they're funnier, right? Success isn't really funny. Failure is.
Yeah.
It's like the last few years we touched upon at the beginning about how, you know, the censoriousness of the West became kind of awful the last few years. Yeah. But what was I going to say?
About failure?
Well, because you just can't. There's nothing to fear. Like, because you'll get better if you keep going, and people like watching it. I think what they like to watch is how you cope with failure.
Yeah.
You know, well, that's exciting.
We saw that on Monday night.
Yes.
You stepped in Dave Foley's shoes to try and do a sketch that he's famous for.
Yes. And I failed to the lies.
And the audience loved it because they're watching a guy completely screw up, and somehow that delights them. It frees them, you know?
Yeah. That will be one of my favorite memories of all time as a performer, taking you on a classic sketch that Dave and Kevin did, and I wasn't trying to imitate Dave, but I was trying to get that chemistry that Kevin and Dave have, which you can't fake it. And I went off the rails within the first 30 seconds. But what people enjoy is they want to see you pick yourself up, and they want to see you continue. And what people, and an audience is interesting because they may be hundreds, thousands of people, but when they're together in a crowd like that watching something singular, they're one organism. They become one thing. Mm-hmm. And so what you can never show on stage is weakness, because they will turn on you and they're waiting for weakness. And so if you fail or you screw something up and you show weakness, the audience will sense that and they will pounce. And so you have to maintain, I guess, a lie on stage that everything's good, everything's fine. I meant for this to happen. This can't bother me. And that's just such an interesting and fun dance, you know. And now things don't really bother me. I used to be thrown quite easily, but not really now. No.
Wow.
Because, yeah.
Well said, well said. Powerful words there, Scott Thompson. Powerful words. Through your failure.
Well, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Mm. What does someone say? Try and fail. Just keep try and fail. Fail, fail, fail.
But
I mean, we fail more than we
work. You have to do good work.
Yes, of course. Eventually you'll win. But I think we fail more than we don't.
Mm. Well, I have to say, Paul Bellini, Scott Thompson, thank you for your time. Well said, well done, well recorded, Mouth Congress.
Well recorded, yes.
Thanks for being on the show.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you, Mark.
That was my flashback interview with Kids in the Hall, Scott Thompson and Paul Bellini. For more on Mouth Congress and their new album, Valley of Song, simply visit mouthcongress.com. And for all things Kids in the Hall, simply visit kidsinthehall.ca. Up next, hour two of Rainbow Country.
Since she married the most for a total of 9 times.
Oh, please. I think it's Eva, because she was hilarious on Green Acres and she just adores a penthouse view.
It's Magda, because she wasn't even a movie star, and yet she still got married 6 times.
Come on, it's Jolie, because she was an actual Jewish jeweler who fled the Nazis and gave birth to these incredible bras.
No, it's Zsa, because she slapped the cop into Tom Britton as a girl who danced with Hitler and lived to 99.
No, it's Eva, because she got it right when she married a gay man. Talk show host, a gay show mogul, Merv Griffin.
Merv, give it to Eva. Merv, give it to Lisa.
Listening to Kingston's only campus community radio station, broadcasting 24/7, 365 on 101.9 FM and CFRC.ca. Tune in for the best local programming.
Hi, this is Michael Anthony Alago, music executive, photographer, author, and you are listening to Rainbow Country with Mark Tara.
This is Hour 2 of Rainbow Country, where I feature music from LGBT artists, independent artists, voices that we've come to know and love in classic disco, classic 80s, classic house, So if you stay with me